Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event, and I'd like to welcome our online and radio audiences as well as our live audience here in San Francisco at the club's headquarters. You can find the club at www.commonwealthclub.org. We have our online calendar there, and the club puts on over 450 events a year. Now, tonight, it's my great pleasure to introduce Mark Shaw, and I'm going to be very modern about this. Didn't even bring a piece of paper today. Mark Shaw is a former criminal defense attorney and legal analyst for CNN, ESPN, and USA Today. Mark is the author of more than 20 books, including The Poisoned Patriarch, Miscarriage of Justice, Beneath the Mask of Holiness, Down for the Court Count, and Stations Along the Way. Mr. Shaw has written for the New York Daily News, USA Today, Huffington Post, and the Aspen Daily News. More about Mark, who lives in the San Francisco area, may be learned at markshawbooks.com, thereporterwhoknewtoomuch.com, and thedorothykilgallenstory.org. So here to talk about his new book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, Mark Shaw.
On November 8, 1965, a 52-year-old woman was found dead in her New York City townhouse. Quickly, an autopsy was conducted with the conclusion that the woman died of a combination of barbiturates and alcohol, circumstances undetermined. Despite this confusing message, no investigation resulted. And worse, despite no evidence that Kilgallen had a drug problem or an alcoholic problem, no one stood up for her. Not her family, not her friends, not the people she worked with, no one. More than 10,000 people attended her funeral, but she was buried and for the next 50 years forgotten, erased from people's mind with her great body of work never given the attention it deserves. That is, until now. The name of that woman was Dorothy Mae Kilgallen, and as you will learn, she was murdered because she was the reporter who knew too much.
Time now for everybody's favorite guessing game, What's My Line?
First, the popular columnist whose voice of Broadway appears in papers from coast to coast, Miss Dorothy Kilgallen.
So how many out there remember Dorothy Kilgallen from What's My Line? Well, you know what? That's what I remembered her from. That's what I remembered her from. I didn't know the other side to her life. In fact, I never intended to write this book at all. Let me tell you how I did, and then I want to take you on the journey with me as to how I learned more about Dorothy. This is actually the third book in a trilogy that I've written about the JFK assassination. I got interested in it when I wrote a book called Melvin Belli, King of the Courtroom. Many of you remember Mr. Belli, San Francisco flamboyant lawyer. Famous clients, Muhammad Ali, the Rolling Stones, Tammy Faye Baker. He was the lawyer of the 20th century, the great tort lawyer and all of that. I practiced law at the time in the 80s, and I had an office in his building down on Montgomery Street. Probably many of you have seen that office from the street. They had a bus line tour that used to go by it. And Belli would wave, you know, and everything. Well, I got to know him really well to the point where at one point he invited me to go to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game in his gold Rolls Royce, Candlestick Park. People treated him like a rock star, okay? But as I started to investigate Belli's life for writing this book, I started to learn about his affection for the mafia. One of his associates said, the mafia loved Belli and he loved the mafia. Spent time in Las Vegas. His other famous client at the time was Mickey Cohen, who was the infamous Los Angeles gangster. So here's what I began to wonder about, because who was the other famous client that Melvin Belli had? Jack Ruby. Jack Ruby, the same Jack Ruby that shot Lee Harvey Oswald, that allegedly shot John F. Kennedy. And so I'm a curious guy, and I kept looking into that, and I kept wondering about this curious defense that Belli used, which was an insanity defense, psychomotor epilepsy insanity defense. to defend Ruby. I mean, any of you could have taken this man. He supposedly killed the most hated man in the world, Lee Harvey Oswald, and taken him into a courtroom, thrown him on the mercy of the court, and got him 5 years in prison. Belli used that defense. He wouldn't let Ruby testify, and what happened? Ruby was given the death penalty. Well, I didn't know what made sense there. So I thought, you know, that's interesting. I'm going to try to prove that we can go all the way back to Joe Kennedy and show that maybe this whole mafia cycle started with Joe Kennedy and all the way through then to Jack Ruby and Melvin Belli and Lee Harvey Oswald and all of that. So I did some research there, and I wrote a book called The Poison Patriarch, How the Betrayals of Joseph P. Kennedy Caused the Assassination of JFK. It was published about 3 or 4 years ago. And what I did, I went back to the 1960 election. Many of you may know JFK was going to lose that election. But Joe called in at the last minute many of his friends in the mafia, Giancana, Marcello, all these magical names back there, and they helped JFK win Illinois and West Virginia, and they won the election. Well, Joe had made a deal with the devil, and that deal was that if they helped JFK win the election, the new administration would leave those guys alone. And I had a primary witness who was right there when Joe Kennedy pulled his double cross. Respected journalist who was there the night when Joe Kennedy ordered JFK to appoint Bobby Kennedy attorney general. And what did Bobby Kennedy do? He went after those guys. And the main one was a mafioso in New Orleans named Carlos Marcello, who will figure in as we go through what happened to Dorothy Kilgallen. Bobby Kennedy deported him. He got back in the United States, so he charged him with racketeering and put him in a courtroom. As November 1963 came along, what was Marcello going to do? His back was to the wall. Well, I proved, I believe, in the Poison Patriarch exactly what happened. They couldn't put up with that. Marcello couldn't. So what did he do? If you kill Bobby Kennedy, Jack Kennedy comes after you with everything the government has. But if you kill Jack Kennedy, what happens? Bobby Kennedy is powerless. And that's exactly what happened. So I believe the book, which was well received, well reviewed, that was it. I was done. But then, while I was researching the Melvin Belli book, I talked to a doctor friend of Belli's in San Diego. And that doctor said, you know, Mel knew Dorothy Kilgallen really well. I said, what, the game show panelist? He said, no, Mark, you don't know anything about her. She had another side to her life. She was a great investigative reporter, journalist, all these things, but also she covered the Jack Ruby trial. I said, you got, really? He said, yes, and you need to look into that. But let me tell you something, what Belli told me right after Dorothy died. He said, they've killed Dorothy. Now they're going after Ruby. They've killed Dorothy, now they're going after Ruby. And I could not get that quote out of my mind. And that's what triggered the book that you will know about today. I want to take you, as I said, on the journey, though, to figure out exactly what happened to Kilgallen. Let's first of all look at this photograph, which you're familiar with, right? You can name the people in that photograph, most of you probably. Arlene Francis, Bennett Cerf, the founder of Random House, who plays into Dorothy's death, and the host was John Charles Daly. On CBS for 15 years, I think, or 17 years, watched every Sunday night by 20 million people. And Dorothy was the star, wasn't she? She was the powerful person up there. Bennett Cerf, she acted like a prosecutor, and she did. She may have been dressed with Fifth Avenue clothes, but she wanted to find the truth. She wanted to win. And that's how she approached that, and that's how she approached her life, and that's where, in many ways, as you will see, she picked up enemies all along the way. So I knew that, okay? But then I started to look in this side of her as a journalist. She was a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist. How many of you knew that? You didn't. I didn't. I missed it. Well, she was. Journal American, New York Journal American was her newspaper, Voice of Broadway was her column. 200 newspapers syndicated that column every day. And you have to remember back then, where did people get their news? They got it to the newspaper. Television was kind of around the three networks, whatever, but that's where they got their news. The New York Post called her the most powerful female voice in America. Ernest Hemingway called her the greatest female writer in the world. And I have another quote in here in a minute. Randolph Hearst. I love this one. Dorothy had three trademarks: a keen mind, a tailored exterior, and the steel rod as a backbone. She was life and death. She reached into precipices of people's emotions, both in her writings and her personal confrontations with her own existence. She was enthusiastic, open, full of life. And before I forget, I will tell you what the thing she was most dedicated to was: the truth. And the one word that describes her is integrity. And how many people I have heard from around the world who have gotten in touch with me by email or whatever, who have said, "Boy, I wish Dorothy Kilgallen were around today." We need that kind of a reporter, not this fake news stuff that we hear, because that wasn't something Dorothy would have permitted. So we had the Voice of Broadway column. It was part gossip. It was part entertainment about Broadway and all of that. But she picked some tough issues in there as well to talk about. But more than that, what I learned, this is my favorite photo of Dorothy. And where is she? Well, she covered some of the greatest trials of the 20th century as an investigative reporter. The Lindbergh baby kidnapping case, the Lenny Bruce First Amendment case, the Profumo English scandal. But here she is at the Dr. Sam Shepard case. And for you, of those who don't know, it was a sensational case of a doctor supposedly killing his wife. It became the foundation for what film? The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. Look at those reporters. Who's the star of the trial? Every trial she ever went to, what's the first thing the judge did? He didn't pound his gavel like George did. They asked her to come into the chambers and get an autograph. That's how popular she was. And that's where her power came from. So, we know about that side of her. I will also tell you, she was an adventurer. She was in a race around the world, one of the first women to do that. She wrote a book at an early age. There's nobody in the world that can touch Dorothy Kilgallen in terms of what she did. I don't care if it's Oprah or Diane Sawyer or whatever. And she broke the glass ceiling before we even knew what that meant, all the time while raising three kids. So let's learn more about her, as I did. The JFK assassination. How in the world did Dorothy Kilgallen get involved in the JFK assassination? Well, in 1963, she was 50 years old, the top of her game, the most respected reporter in the country. But the JFK assassination, I learned, was not a business situation for her. The next image that you will see is Dorothy with her youngest son, Kerry, at their townhouse home on the east side of Manhattan. Kerry was a youngster, and Kilgallen knew JFK from social events. He had been to her home. They saw each other at what they called the Stork Club and all of that. But she took little Kerry to the White House, and Pierre Salinger arranged a tour. And while they were doing this, they were in the library, and JFK came in. And he went ahead and he gave little Kerry a PT-109 pin for his lapel, and looked at some letters she had brought from his third grade class. Well, that meant a lot to her, as you can imagine. So when JFK died, one of her columns read, "The picture that stays in my mind is one of this tall young man bending over a small boy, carefully scrutinizing envelopes until he came to the name Kerry Arden Calmer, grade 3B. This is the man who was assassinated in Dallas." Well, Bennett Cerf said of Dorothy, when she went after a story, boy, you couldn't stop her, and so she started in. And she used her sources, the best ones in the country, inside the Dallas Police Department, wherever she could find information, and she started this thick investigative file with all of her documents, with all of the interviews, with everything that she had. And at the Ruby trial, she started in 7 days after JFK was killed. And you have to remember, at that time, who was shouting the Oswald alone theory, all of that? None other than J. Edgar Hoover. And in both of these books, you can see why I say he was doing that. Because if a lone nut killed the president, he's not responsible. If it's any sort of group that do, he is responsible. So he's shouting Oswald alone over here, and there's only one reporter shouting Oswald alone makes no sense. And who is that reporter but Dorothy Kilgallen? This is her first article. The Oswald file must not close. She then wrote one called Still Live Topic, saying, I'm not going away. I'm going to keep looking into this. You can imagine what J. Edgar Hoover must have thought of what Dorothy was doing. Then she wrote this one, DA to link Ruby to Oswald. I have never seen another article that said this was what was going to happen at trial. It didn't, but Dorothy knew that there was that link there. We can tell by her writings. And then, besides her writing the columns, what did she do? She never looked at this direction where J. Edgar Hoover wanted everybody to look, the Oswald thing. She looked at who? Jack Ruby. She knew he was the key to the JFK assassination, and that's why she ingratiated herself at the Ruby trial with the defense. And who headed the defense? Melvin Belli and his co-counsel, Joe Tannehill. So she got to the courtroom, probably wondering what this stack of books here is. Well, I'm going to get to that a little bit later, but I will tell you, that's all of these bright, seasoned, experienced, well-researched, whatever you want to call them, experts on the JFK assassination. All right? Want to bet how many of them even mentioned Dorothy Kilgallen? I'll tell you later. But when she got to court, she took over. And this is the first one of the columns in the Dallas Morning News. Dorothy Kilgallen arrived in court yesterday and stopped the show. The judge, one of her fans, gallantly granted an interview and got an autograph. In his chambers, Melvin Belli of San Francisco and Joe Tannehill took her to lunch at a nearby seafood house called Vincent's, whose oysters, Belli declared, are the best this side of his native city's Fisherman's Wharf. All right? So she was there. And in these books, there's even one gentleman that I will mention derogatorily that even says Dorothy was not even at the Ruby trial. Not even there. Well, I'm going to show you that she was. Here's the first picture. Who's she with? Tannehill and Belli. And if that isn't enough, let's watch her at a news conference with Belli and Tannehill.
Prospectively, here in Dallas and away from Dallas, when we are moved, we may have to take some who have seen it on TV, not because they're qualified, but because eventually we want to get to trial. But we're not going to go to trial here unless we're forced to trial with witnesses who saw this on TV.
How long does a person have to live in Dallas County to be a prospective juror?
What are the residents required?
A year in the
community?
State and 6 months in the county.
Is there any chance that you might get a transplanted Chicagoan or New Yorker or someone from another state?
Just had one
who sat in the jury up in New York.
The one we challenged for cause to keep from being disbarred.
So, we know she was there, right? All right, you have to understand how important that is because Dorothy Kilgallen, the game show woman, right? Game show woman, is the only reporter out of 400 there who interviews who? Jack Ruby. And she did it twice. All right? How did that happen? Joe Tannehill, the co-counsel, will tell you what Ruby thought of Kilgallen.
I think Jack was highly impressed with Dorothy Kilgallen. And he figured she was a very classy person. She had good programs on What's My Line, and she was a highly intelligent person. And I think that of all the writers that were down there during the Ruby trial, about 400 from all over the world, she probably was the one that, to him, was the most significant. So she was in the entertainment business. She had a strip joint, and he looked upon her as someone that may be able to help him. He was trying to get help from everybody he could that had any significant standing in the community or anywhere else. He was a name dropper, you know.
And how did the interview take place?
She told me that she had had a contact with a friend of Jack's from San Francisco. I believe it was an opera singer that he was very fond of, and she wanted to pass along a message to him. And I told Jack that, and he said, yeah, I'd like to talk with her. And I told the four guards, Jack had a bodyguard shield around him of four deputy sheriffs sitting there behind him, you know, and everywhere he went. And I told them and she wanted to ask Jack some questions and speak with him at recess, and that he had agreed to it, and they said, okay. So at when the judge declared the noon recess, Jack went over and spoke with her.
I see. Where did they talk? Was it in the hallway?
No, it was in the courtroom right behind his chair where he was sitting. There was a rail there, and he got up and went to the... She was on the other side of the rail. Jack was on this side, and they had a little conversation. I think the press had already left the courtroom at that time.
I see. Approximately how long did they talk in private?
About 5 minutes.
I see. In the book by Lee Israel, it says 8 minutes, but something...
Yeah, I say about, more or less.
Approximately, okay. And did you hear anything they said that was important?
She started out mentioning the fact that this opera singer in San Francisco had spoken with her about Jack, and she wanted to tell him, so I didn't pay much attention to what they were saying.
Do you know the name of the opera singer?
No.
Or so we don't know if the opera singer is still alive?
No.
I see. And did this opera singer ever turn up at another time in the trial?
No, but Jack was very enthusiastic about her, so they must have been pretty close friends.
So there we have it, you see? She was right there. That's history, ladies and gentlemen. That's history. Okay, I've never seen that before, and I'll tell you how I found it later on here. And also, I should tell you that at the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, all of Kilgallen's columns, her articles, quotes about her, photos, and more than 50 videotapes that I'll tell you how I got those, are posted so people can look at them. That's the credibility for this book. It's not speculation. It's primary sources so that you can go in and judge for yourself exactly what happened. So, as you can imagine, that didn't make Dorothy too much of a likable person to those who were worried about what she was doing. So she went on and she wrote about things, but next Dorothy made the biggest exclusive of the time. I'd say it's close to what happened with the Nixon tapes being exposed, or perhaps Snowden with government secrets and all of that, because what did Dorothy Kilgallen do? She exposed exposed Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission, before its release date. Before its release date. And they tried to find out what her source was. They did all these kind of things to her, but she wouldn't tell. She said, I'd rather die than tell my sources. You have to think how big that was at the time, and you're going to hear one of Kilgallen's closest friends, a hairdresser, tell you about how scared she was, how frightened she was after this happened. But here's what she wrote. I don't want to miss this. And Kilgallen was a gifted wordsmith, that's for sure. She wrote in one of her columns, at any rate, the whole thing smells a bit fishy. It's might too simple that a chap kills the President of the United States, escapes from that bother, kills a policeman, eventually is apprehended in a movie theater under circumstances that defy every law of police procedure, and subsequently is murdered under extraordinary circumstances. Kilgallen was on the job, no question about it. All right, so I knew that about her. So where did I turn next? I turned into trying to find a window into Kilgallen's mind between when she was at the Jack Ruby trial and when she died on November 8th, 1952. But I needed help. And I will tell you right now that many times as I was working on this book, I felt like Dorothy was right there with me. It may sound strange, but I felt her spirit at times. I felt like she was guiding me to evidence when I was going to quit and all of that. And what I'm going to tell you about, there's no question that I think Dorothy helped me, because I was about done and I didn't think I had enough to write the book. But I was researching and I found an article in a 2007 Midwest magazine, where they had focused on celebrities from the Midwest. Dorothy was born in Chicago, ended up in New York City. And this article had all sorts of interesting material in it about Dorothy's death. It was who killed Dorothy Kilgallen. And I found that there was a hairdresser who was interviewed. There, two of them. There was this one woman who was one of the last people to see Kilgallen There was a contestant on What's My Line, and Joe Tannehill, who had given an interview. And so I called this publisher, and I said, I'd really like to talk to those people. He said, Mark, the bad news, they're all dead. And I said, no. And he said, well, the good news is there's a woman in L.A. who was obsessed with Kilgallen's death, and she videotaped the interviews. And that's what you'll see on the DorothyKilgallen.org site. And this is what saved the book, and this is what provides the primary sources. So let's look at a couple of these. Mark Sinclair was arguably Kilgallen's closest friend. You can keep going. He was her main hairdresser. She confided to him with regard to things. And he's going to be able to tell us what she was doing somewhat between the time that she was at the Ruby trial and as we get closer to her death. Let's hear right now from Mark Sinclair about what he knew about her investigation.
She wouldn't stop on it. Pre-warn exclusive, yeah. So she had it all. And she told me all about this, and she told Donnell was there too, so I mean, he knew. We knew what she was doing.
At this time, did
she said that this would be the case of a lifetime, a story of a lifetime, that she would prove that the president was assassinated. Who assassinated the president?
Boy, that's chills you, doesn't it, to hear that? This is what she was going to do. All right, so we know she was at the Ruby trial. Well, where did she go next? She didn't go to Dallas to look into LBJ being involved in JFK's death. She didn't go to Washington to look into the CIA or one of those theories that's way out there. Where did she go? Sinclair knows.
Did Dorothy say that when she traveled with you in the future, she wanted to stay in a separate hotel?
And she said that when we were in New Orleans. She called me, and I went there to do her hair so she'd look better in the pictures that were being taken of her. And she called me, and she said, you have your ticket. I want you to go back to New York, and I don't want you to ever tell anyone that you were here with me.
Okay, well, let's say more about this. This happened, I'd say, approximately a month or 6 weeks before she died. You were in New York, and you got a phone call from her, and she said she was in New Orleans, right?
No. She went down on one plane, and I went down on the other at the same time. And I stayed in a different hotel than she did. And she told me we were going to have dinner that evening. And I'd done her hair and left the hotel and was fooling around town. And she said, she called me and she said, I want you to leave immediately. I don't want you to tell anyone you were ever here with me. I don't want anyone to know that you were ever here with me. And don't ask me any more questions. And I got on the plane and flew back to New York.
What I like about many of these interviews, as you will see, these people, the hairdressers and everybody else, you saw where she stopped the interviewer and said, no, that's not right. You know, I was a courtroom guy. When you had witnesses who said those kind of things, who just didn't go along with whatever a prosecutor, defense attorney wanted to, you believed them. These guys are believable. And then this one is gonna, if it doesn't, I'll be surprised to throw a chill up your spine. Here's Sinclair talking about threats to her life.
Around this time, you used to get her ready for her What's My Line show, and you would sometimes play the game of What's My Line.
Yeah,
with her
I played it all the time. Yes,
where you would pretend to be a contestant, like you make.
We would play the game. Donnell was there, and we would play the game around her.
While you were playing the game once, did she ever say something out of the blue about threats on her life?
Yes. She told me that this is a couple of weeks before she died, or maybe 3 or 4 weeks before she died. I'm not sure of the time anymore. But she told me she was going to get a gun because her life was being threatened, and she was scared for her life and for her family.
Going to get a gun. Afraid for her life and her family. Second hairdresser is Charles Simpson. He's aware also of what she's working on. Let's hear from him.
Did you have the feeling that she was investigating the...
Skip this part.
The murder case of Jack Ruby killing Oswald and Oswald killing Kennedy? Was she digging into that?
She never quit. She never quit. She dug up something. she dug up something about the assassination of President Kennedy that somebody didn't want her to know, because she even told us of her own volition. She said, I used to share things with you guys, and she said, but after I have found out now what I know, she said, if the wrong people knew what I know, it would cost me my life. And she was dead about 9 months later.
The wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination. It would cost me my life. And as far as the Warren Commission revelations from Jack Ruby, Simpson again.
She had a copy of the Warren Commission testimony sometime before.
She printed it on the front page of the Journal American before the president received it. And therein lies the tale. From then on, we were stalked.
Who's we?
Mark, myself, our phones were tapped. They were trying to find out where she got her information from. That she could get this information before the president got it, who was then President Johnson.
So there we go again, okay? We know what she was going to do, and then Dorothy was planning a second trip to New Orleans. Who was in New Orleans? Carlos Marcello. Motive, I mean, come on. Figure it all out, motive. She knew where she was going. She connected these people. There's no question about that. And Dorothy was working on that book for Random House, and you can imagine who was watching very carefully what she did. We have an FBI file where it shows the columns of Kilgallen's, and beside those columns, there are the words WRONG, three times on there, handwriting of who? J. Edgar Hoover. Enemies, Marcello, Hoover, all of these people watching this woman who is the only person. Mark Lane said she was the only serious journalist investigating the JFK assassination, and that was true. So now we get close to November 8, 1965. We know she's scared. We know, you didn't see that, but she was going to change her will. She was worried about her son, Kerry, being kidnapped when she saw a photograph of him running across Central Park in a newspaper. All of that was going on in her mind, but that wouldn't stop somebody like Dorothy Kilgallen. You know, she thought she was powerful. She knew that she was going to go after this no matter what, because why? JFK, she knew that he had not been killed just by Oswald, and she was going to prove it in that book. So what do we know about her? Because there's three ways that Kilgallen could have died: accidental death, suicide, or murder. Well, suicide doesn't make any sense whatsoever. She had everything going for her. She was at the top of her career. She had a movie deal based on this book she was writing for Random House. She was on her way to a trip to London the next couple days. She had all these things going. Suicide makes no sense. Accidental death, we'll talk about in the middle, or murder. So, Mark Sinclair will tell us in just a minute here. Or maybe we'll wait till the video about finding her body. But Mark Sinclair was one of the last people to see her alive. On November 7th, 1965, Kilgallen prepared herself for her last What's My Line program. I watched it again the other night. It's something you might want to watch, and there's a tribute program to her right after that. You know, those What's My Line programs are all over the internet. They're everywhere. That's why so many young people... You know, this book has just gone through the roof, and one of the reasons is because a lot of young people remember her, and it's a true crime murder mystery, and they want to find out what happened to Dorothy Kilgallen. Well, you can see those reruns everywhere. So, we know that Sinclair came over the night just before she was going to go What's My Line. He found some flowers in the lobby that he put in a hairpiece. He helped her with her makeup. He helped her with her fake eyelashes. He got her into a dress that was a long flowing dress. If you ever saw her in What's My Line, she dressed really well. All right. So he got all that done, and then he left. And then he went home, and then she goes to her program. And you can watch that last program. What do you see? Do you see a woman who's slurring her words? Do you see a woman's got a drug problem? Do you see a woman that's got alcoholic problems? No. No, you don't. All of that is made up. You see Kilgallen sharp as can be, funny, trying to find the truth. She even guesses the occupation of a woman who came on there. You know, they had unusual occupations. The woman sold dynamite. And that woman's name is Catherine Stone. And she's going to play into this murder mystery in just a few minutes. So she went to the program. But when Mark Sinclair looked on the television, he noticed she had changed the dress. It wasn't this flowing dress that she was supposed to wear. It was more of a date-like dress. And Kilgallen, at the time, she and her husband had gone separate ways. She had somebody that she was close with. And he believed, at least, that she was probably going to meet that person because she suspected him of leaking her JFK assassination evidence to the wrong people. So Kilgallen does the show. She goes out with a producer to P.J. Clark's, a bar that's still in New York City. I sat right next to the table where she was on that fateful night. And she has a drink there. And then she ends up at the Regency Hotel in a bar there about 6 blocks away from where she lives on East 68th Street. Catherine Stone comes to an after-show party there or get-together there and sees Kilgallen in a booth off in the corner. And you'll see that video on the Dorothy Kilgallen story.org. She describes it, and she sees him with a man, and the man is sitting right next to her. And she says they're not smiling, they're not having fun, they're talking very seriously. And the reason that plays in is because before Mark Sinclair left that night and she went to What's My Line, he suggested that Kilgallen confront the man who she believed was leaking her JFK assassination information. And before we leave tonight, I will tell you who I believe that was. So, what we know is, from a witness who was there, it saw her about 1 o'clock, she called a Western Union manager to get her column picked up at 2 o'clock. What we don't know is what happened between 2 o'clock and 9 o'clock when this happened.
Did she tell you what her plans were for later that night after What's My Line?
She was going home afterwards. But obviously she didn't, because she went to the Regency.
Do you suspect that she got a phone call after you left?
After I left, I think she got a phone call from somebody, and she agreed to meet whoever it was at the Regency. That's my belief, because she wasn't going to Clark's. She had asked me if I wanted to meet her, because she did not have anybody she was going to meet with, and she was not dressing for a date.
Well, she did end up going to Clark's briefly with Bob Bach.
Well, maybe, but not long. But she might have done that and then gone home, but there wouldn't have been an evening like she had.
Why didn't you accept her offer to go with her somewhere?
I was tired myself. She had done something every day that week, and she had more appointments for me the following week. And I didn't want to see anymore. I wanted to go home.
Did she tell you that she had a meeting at her son's school the next
day? Yes, that was Sunday. I did her hair before the show, and she told me to come the next morning before 9. I arrived at the house at 9, used my key. I think it was about 8:30, 8:45. Used my key, let myself in, went upstairs, and Dorothy was dead in her bedroom.
You went to the third floor bedroom that she did not sleep in that room.
She did not sleep in that room. And when I entered, Dorothy was, she was not in that room, but the air conditioning was on. It was cold out. That's the room.
What about that air conditioning vent? Was that?
No, that's the dressing room. Oh, no. That's a heater. That's not an air conditioner. This is the air conditioner.
Oh, that's where it would have been in that position.
Right in that same position. And it was blowing out in that room. And I was here. And the light was on, and she wasn't there. So I turned on my curling irons, and I walked into the bedroom, not thinking that she would be there. And she was sitting up in bed, and I walked over to the bed and touched her, and I knew she was dead right away.
And how was the bed made up?
The bed was spotless. She was dressed very peculiarly. She was dressed like I've never seen her before. She always dressed in pajamas and old socks, and her makeup was off, and her hair was off, and everything was done. She was completely dressed like she was going out. The hair was in place, the makeup was on, the false eyelashes were on, the matching peignoir and robe. a book laid out on the bed, a drink on the table, the light was on, the air conditioning was on, though you didn't need an air conditioner, you would have had the heat on. And she was always cold. And why she had the air conditioning on, I don't know.
Possibly someone else had turned it on.
Well, maybe to keep the body a certain temperature, you know.
Was the glass on the bedside table within her reach?
It was on the right-hand side. No, it was way away, way over. And the book, it was turned upside down. It wasn't in the right position for if you'd been reading, laid it down. And it was laid down so perfectly, you know, like that. And one hand, rigor mortis had set in on one hand, the right hand, and it had drawn up the covers a little bit. And there was lipstick on this sleeve of the bolero jacket. And the light was on, and she was sitting up.
That sound like a stage death scene to you? Circumstances undetermined. Back with what was determined, and we'll talk about the autopsy report in a minute. It doesn't take anybody with many brains to look at that death scene and say, hey, you know, there ought to be an investigation here, okay? Well, I'll tell you, there wasn't. So what we don't know is what happened because Sinclair left. He was scared. What does he know? He knows in his own mind she didn't die accidentally there. Somebody murdered her. And who murdered her? He's got to think. It has to be the same people she was going to expose for being involved in the JFK assassination, these powerful people. When Sinclair and Simpson were interviewed in late 1999 and early 2000, both of them admitted they were still scared then of people coming after them. I have heard from relatives of Kilgallen's in the last few days having to do with an investigation I'll tell you about that's going on who have told me, quote, they're frightened, they're still frightened, and they changed the way their lives were led. This is almost 52 years ago. So what happens? We don't know exactly. Sinclair leaves at 9. When are the authorities called? 3 in the afternoon. 3 in the afternoon. So what do? They come. Well, these two policemen come. They find a Secanol bottle empty by the bedside. On a little table, they look at that, they look at Dorothy. Okay, what did she do? She accidentally died of a drug overdose. They go to a pharmacy, at least they did that, and they find out that she had a prescription for Secanol, but nothing exorbitant, just the normal, because she had problems with sleeping, okay? But that's it. They don't talk to any witnesses except her husband, who's drunk, and he tells them that she was home at 11:30. They'd even checked with anybody over at the Regency Hotel, they would have known that wasn't correct, but they don't do anything. And then we get to the worst part. The medical examiner is called. Where did Kilgallen die? She died in Manhattan, right? They don't call the Manhattan medical examiner's office. They call the Brooklyn office. And Dr. James Luke comes over, and he takes one look at her, accidental death, and confiscates the body and takes it to Brooklyn. Well, as you're going to find out when you read my research, you're going to see that the Brooklyn Medical Examiner's Office, and I have three toxicologists who were there, who, you know, a lot of people are still alive that know about what happened back then, and they will tell you in the book, the Brooklyn Medical Examiner's Office was mafia-controlled at the time. They were forced to sign fake autopsy reports, sometimes using an autopsy report from one body for another one. Well, does all this sound familiar now as you trace all this from what happened at the Ruby trial all the way through with Belli and Ruby and Marcello and all that kind of thing? Somebody decided, didn't they, that Dorothy Kilgallen could not write that book. She could not go back to New Orleans. Well, I'm not the greatest researcher in the world, but here's the autopsy report, okay? So I'm looking down through it. I got it through the National Archives through a friend of my wife's. And I'm looking at it, and I see on there Secanol, okay? Well, that fits with accidental death, doesn't it? And then I look down through it. None of these guys ever even looked at an autopsy report. They never cared anything about it because they are reporters who decide on a conclusion, and then they have the facts fit that conclusion instead of the other way around, like Dorothy Kilgallen did. And what do I see under Secanol? Tylenol. And a good friend of mine, Randy Boris, who knows about these kind of things, tells me something very simple. It's a much stronger sedative. All right? But that didn't fit with that conclusion. I think that's why he wrote Circumstances Undetermined. He didn't know what the hell had happened. So then we find out, I did a little more research, I found the son of a toxicologist who, along with his associate, 3 years later, the associate had kept some of Kilgallen's bodily fluids. Sounds a little strange, but he felt like technology later on might be able to help with testing that, okay? So he kept them. Well, this John Broach and Dr. Charles Umberger looked at those bodily fluids and did their own test. What'd they find? Secanol, Tylenol, and phenobarbital. Three barbiturates in her stomach, not one. Does that sound like accidental death to you? No. And you know what? You would think one cover-up when she died, 3 years later, they're going to take that to the authorities, aren't they? And they're going to let them know what happened, and there's going to be an investigation. No way. Scared to death to do it. The second cover-up, Dorothy denied that justice she deserved. And the eyewitnesses there will tell you about the mafia. They'll tell you about the circumstances under which they had to operate there. In fact, John Broach's widow, who's still alive, said her husband told him Kilgallen was bumped off. Where's that term come from? So I learned all this. And what did I decide to do with it? I wrote the book. Well, I'm amazed at people who've fallen in love with Dorothy. I got a kick out of, I think there's 115 reviews up on Amazon, and I don't look at all of them, but there's one up there today I thought was kind of interesting because apparently by reading the book, this woman wrote, "You know, I can tell by Mr. Shaw's writing he has a crush on Dorothy Kilgallen." Well, I do. I have such respect for her in terms of what happened to her. I don't know about the crush part, but anyway, so I decided when the book came out, I was going to see if I couldn't get an investigation of her death, finally after 52 years, get some justice for this woman. So I wrote a long letter to the New York District Attorney. Here it is. And I said in there that, you know, I felt like that there were 20-some reasons why an investigation, not a reinvestigation, because there was none, investigation was proper. The crux of my argument was this. I believe we've proven there's a homicide. When you have a homicide, what? There's a victim. That victim has rights. All right? Dorothy Kilgallen was a victim. She has the right to an investigation. And I don't care whether it was 50 years ago, 5 days ago, or 5 months ago, murder is murder. And especially because there's a main suspect out there right now who I believe was complicit in Dorothy Kilgallen's death, and I will tell you about that. So I wrote to them. I didn't know if I'd get a response. I thought probably they would send back a nice letter that said, "You know, Mark, we had 25 murders in the Bronx last night. We don't have time for a murder case that's 50 years old." I didn't hear anything. So I sent a second letter, and I told them, "Look, here's some more reasons, and there is this guy out there that needs to be investigated. And here's contact information for all these people you can look at, that you can investigate." And especially, I think I convinced them to maybe do something because of this one suspect. In the book, you're going to read about a guy named Ron Pataki. Ron Pataki was a journalist in Columbus, Ohio. He and Kilgallen had a bit of an affair toward the end of her life. You can put Pataki up there, the poem. Yeah. And so I started looking into Pataki, and I believe he is the mystery man that Dorothy Kilgallen met the night before she died. Why do I believe that? I got a hold of Pataki. First, I read some interviews that he had given and things like that, and then I got a hold of him. I asked him if he'd talk to me. I told him I was a former criminal defense lawyer. I thought he could be a suspect in the murder. He agreed to talk to me. You know, it's just human nature for some reason. There's a good defense lawyer out here that will tell you. Most people who are even suspected of being involved in a crime should have a spool of duct tape with them so that they can cover up their mouth, because most people convict themselves. They always want to give that explanation that makes no sense, and then the tables are turned on them at trial. Pataki talked to me 3 times. I interviewed him. I told him I was recording the conversations. You will see the conflicts in his testimony, his statements in the book. But The Keeper are 2 poems that he wrote. The first one, now you tell me whether, now Ron tells me he denies everything, by the way. And he told me that neither one of these poems have anything to do with Dorothy Kilgallen. See if you agree. The first one is called Never Trust a Stiff at a Typewriter. There's a way to quench a gossip stench that never fails. One cannot write if zippered tight. Somebody who's dead can tell no tales. And then this one. See the little guy? That's a bartender. We think that Kilgallen, we believe, and I think there's proof in the book, that these barbiturates were administrated to her the night before she died there at the Regency Hotel or in her apartment. And in the book, you will find out how that whole scenario works and how I think it happened, a plausible way of it happening. But here, what do we have? We have a bartender. While I'm spilling my guts, she is driving me nuts. Spilling my guts. Leaking information. Please fetch us 2 drinks on the run. Just skip all the noise and make one of them poison. And don't even tell me which one. So I put that in my little letter to the district attorney. And a second one. And then, by golly, two weeks ago Sunday, Sue Edelman, who's a champion of Dorothy's cause, a reporter for the New York Post, released an article that said the New York District Attorney is investigating Dorothy's death. 52 years later. And to the extent that they've appointed an assistant district attorney and investigator to work with me, and I've been sending them new information that I've gotten, even something as recent as yesterday. So one thing I don't want to forget tonight, if any of you know anybody that was alive back then, that may have known Melvin Belli, for instance, if he told that doctor what I said, they've killed Dorothy, maybe he blabbermouthed it to somebody else. On the East Coast, we're especially looking for people who may have heard things about Dorothy's death. And if you find out any facts, little as they may be, I hope that you will let me know or let the district attorney know. So, you may be asking, what do I think would have happened if Dorothy Kilgallen had lived? Well, all the research I've done, all the help that I've gotten from so many people led me to a conclusion that I think is realistic. All right? We know what she was doing. We know how dangerous it was. The killers won here, by the way. You realize the killers won here. Her JFK assassination file disappears. None of her JFK assassination material is in any of these books. Not Bill O'Reilly, not Case Closed by Gerald Posner, not Stephen King's novel, where in the back he talks about how much he believes in the Oswald Alone theory. And this is the topper, Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor of Charles Manson, who wrote a book called Reclaiming History that ought to be called Distorting History. 20 years he spent on this. Think Dorothy Kilgallen's in there? Of course not. And you know why he's not? She's not? Because I knew Vincent Bugliosi. When I was working on Melvin Belli's work, I told him about Belli. I told him about Dorothy. You think it's in there? Of course not, because it didn't fit the conclusion that he wanted. It didn't fit the conclusion that he wanted. So, what do I think would have happened to Dorothy? All right. When you read my research, you can make up your own mind. You can make up your mind as to who was the person who actually committed the murder. You can make up your mind who was involved with that. My books are books where I ask people to stop and think based on the facts. I'm not going to tell you what I think. I'm going to have you make up your own mind based on the facts, based on these videos, based on what happened. So here's what I wrote in the book. What I hoped would have happened if 52 years old, ladies and gentlemen, that's just sad, isn't it? Right at the top of her profession, one of the most courageous reporters. When I've heard from people around the world, I've heard from a woman who went to her grave and scraped the leaves off of her and said a prayer for her, who's taking flowers to her grave. I've heard of a woman who believes her picture should be on a postage stamp, one who said she should be looked upon as a true patriot for what she was trying to do. The deaths of Dorothy Kilgallen and John F. Kennedy were masterminded by the same people. There's little question about that. And my hope is, you may be asking, for instance, what can you do? Well, you can help me if you can find, if you know about any evidence of any kind, that would be great. You can tell people about the research. You can tell them about her story. I'm hoping that her reputation will be restored because she was looked at as what? A drug addict and an alcoholic, despite this incredible body of work that she had. So what would have happened? Returning to New York City from New Orleans with her new evidence connecting Marcello, Oswald, and Ruby, Kilgallen completed her JFK and Oswald's assassination investigation. She exposed the evidence in a series of Journal American articles, or perhaps more likely, organized the material into manuscript form so that Bennett Cerf could have rushed her book into publication at Random House. That was her goal. Either way, Kilgallen's conclusions that the JFK and Oswald assassinations were simply part of a very successful mob operation, it appears certain, would have shown through. Soon after, the shocking evidence Kilgallen revealed triggered a full-scale grand jury investigation of the twin assassinations. With Kilgallen as a star witness and her evidence having triggered a full-scale investigation, including subpoenaing of relevant witnesses, the grand jury issued an indictment charging Carlos Marcello and his Dallas underlings with conspiracy to murder JFK and Oswald. Based on the same evidence Kilgallen produced, J. Edgar Hoover was indicted. The charge was obstruction of justice by deliberately preventing any investigation of the twin assassinations. He resigned pending the outcome of the court proceedings. Through Kilgallen's disclosures, disbarment proceedings were filed against Melvin Belli for having compromised Jack Ruby's constitutional rights to adequate representation. Ruby's new attorney was working on a plea agreement with the Dallas prosecutors that would save her life. And here's my favorite part. Instead of being forgotten through the years, Kilgallen's findings were included in any and all discussion and debates about the JFK assassination. That should happen from now on with all of these so-called experts on notice. As a result of a relentless search for what really occurred in Dallas in November 1963, Kilgallen's theories became part of the historical record. For her tireless dedication to truth and justice, Dorothy Kilgallen earned the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism. In the audience, husband Richard and her children loudly applauded their wife and mother, a true beacon of inspiration, whose work acumen served as a role model to men and women alike. Of all the careers that Dorothy Kilgallen had, what was the one that she loved most? Well, I kept wondering about that as I wrote this book. And finally, you may remember a program called Person to Person with Edward R. Murrow. And there is a whole show of his dedicated to Dorothy Kilgallen, her husband and children and all of that. You can watch that on the internet, at least most of it. But there was one little clip that stayed with me that I always thought about when I was trying to figure out how to tell the truth about Dorothy's story. What she loved the most. Let's listen to her. Watch her and listen to her.
Dorothy, if you had to be confined to one job of the many that you do, which would it be?
Well, Ed, I love television. I have so much fun on What's My Line, playing the game, and I love our morning radio program, too. But I think that I would have to settle for my first love and my true love, the newspaper business. It still has me and always will, I think, I hope.
What was it, the newspaper business? 52 years old, they stopped her, the worst form of censorship you can possibly have. But yeah, Dorothy Kilgallen was the best. She fought for justice her entire life. And now I believe she deserves the justice she was denied so long ago. So you may notice my little button here, and there's some up here if you'd like to take them. It says, Justice for Dorothy. And that's what I say, justice for Dorothy Kilgallen. Thank you.
So, Thank you very much, Mark. I'd like to remind our audience online that they just listened to Mark Shaw speak about the reporter who knew too much, an investigation into the murder of Dorothy Kilgallen 52 years ago. We could squeeze in two or three questions if someone would like to ask a question. Just come up to the mic.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned books that you'd read. I wonder if you're in contact with or if you've read the book, which came out many years ago, 1980, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. Peter Dale Scott's around. He lives in Berkeley and might be somebody that you would want to have read the book of and so on. It's been, the story has been, which is mostly about CIA working with the mafia and the various other actors, Secret Service, Dallas Police, and so on, which you know about. But what about his work?
Well, you know, again, you know, I don't like to say bad things about anybody. I don't think that's a very good thing to do. But I will tell you, there's not one mention of Dorothy Kilgallen's research in that book. And I don't know how all these people missed it. You know, it's just amazing to me. I'm not a great researcher and all of that, but it's been out there for all that time. So I just have to say, any book that doesn't take into account what, I mean, simple research would show that Dorothy Kilgallen was involved in all of this. Yeah. So it's just hard for me to understand how people can disregard that. Now, his findings, I'm all for all the other theories and everything like that. But unless they've got Dorothy's research and investigation as part of the equation, I think they're all incomplete.
Mark, just one thing. You have that, the facts about that she was involved and so on and so forth, but you did say that all of her research disappeared. So the fact that she was researching it is clear, but what she had uncovered has disappeared, right?
Yeah, and all you can do, I mean, I wish it was there, and I'm hoping through the DA's investigation, maybe that file is out there, but all we can do is trace, you know, from the Ruby trial through her death and through these eyewitnesses. There's almost 50 videos. There's more information on that website, the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. We can only assume what she was doing and look at her footprint. Like I said, where did she go after the Ruby interviews?
Yeah, it's she very went, clear.
Yes.
But the evidence disappeared.
It disappeared. I mean, the file disappeared.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have two questions. Did I understand that you're saying that it was this Pataki character to whom she confided the evidence that she had and that you believe he leaked the information to the mob?
There were only two people that she really shared her information with. You may remember Mark Lane. The book was called, I think, Rush to Judgment. Respected guy. I'm a little bit apologetic because I wanted to interview him. I did not know that he was in bad health. And he died before I could. She shared information with him, and you'll read about that in my research. But Pataki was the one who conveniently came into her life, as you will see. Everything points in his direction. And I'm certainly hoping that, you know, there will be an investigation of him, and I will be very surprised if not, especially after I sent them some information yesterday, again, with conflicting information that he has provided through the years.
And what about J. Edgar Hoover? You're implying that he was complicit in this. How so, and what evidence do you have about that?
Well, I can't tell you everything, or you'll end up, you know, you won't look in this book. I really set it up as a true crime murder mystery, okay? There's five suspects in there, all right, including Pataki. But J. Edgar Hoover certainly had to be one of them, and why? Because he's one of the people who really gained a great deal from Kilgallen dying, because she could not... Do what? She could not write that book. She could not expose the fact that he had impeded the investigation and all of that. So he had a lot to gain. So I think he's certainly a viable suspect. Yes, ma'am.
I was just curious if there's been any role of the children in your research. Yeah. And I'm assuming her husband's probably passed away by now.
Well, and that's part of the story. Dorothy had three children. You saw Carrie. The middle one was Jill, and the older one was Dickie Jr. Richard Colmer was her husband. He was a Broadway producer. When she met him, he was on top of the world. Unfortunately, being Mr. Dorothy Kilgallen was not easy. He had some failed businesses. His Broadway shows didn't do well, and he had some alcoholic problems, and they went their separate ways. When Dorothy died, Jill and Dorothy had some arguments right before she died, but when Dorothy died, and all signs pointed to what? She was a drug addict and an alcoholic. That wasn't very easy for the kids to take, was it? And then what happened to Richard? I think it's 3 years later he committed suicide. So I tried to get a hold of all three. I got a hold of Jill. I told her what I was going to do with regard to the book. And she said, well, I don't know if I'm going to, I don't know if we can cooperate or not. I think the three kids are still scared. But I said, all right, I'll do this for you. I'll send you my manuscript. And if you three do not want me to publish it, I won't do so. But I said, if I don't hear from you, I'm going to write this book. And I never heard from her. So that's what happened. My hope is that I will hear from them at some point. This is the first third of the book is really a tribute to Dorothy, that their mother's voice is being heard again, respected, all of that. I have heard from some other relatives of Dorothy's. I don't want to go into who they are exactly because, as I said, they're a little bit scared. But they're starting to, I think, trust me, and hopefully they will give me some information that they have, especially one piece of evidence that's very important. But as of yet, I haven't heard from the children.
All right, we have time for one last question.
I remember at the time of her death reading in the paper that her death was questionable and that there were a whole series of people that had died under mysterious circumstances surrounding the Kennedy assassination. And she was one of them. So this has come out in the press before where there have been questions about her death. Is that correct?
Yes. There's one woman, especially Florence Smith, who lived blocks from her. And there was the speculation that Dorothy had shared information with her. Completely false. No evidence that I ever found connected that or made that even plausible. Dorothy was very close-mouthed with her sources and with telling people, and I think there's only two people she told. So I'm really an opponent of speculation. And all of those things where they say all these deaths are connected and things like that, if I couldn't find primary sources that connected them, I didn't put it in any of these books. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. I don't know if it did or not, but I'm not somebody that's going to throw speculation into this. Yes.
One last one.
One last question. I'd like to congratulate you for restoring the reputation of Dorothy Kilgallen. I'm going to be anxiously waiting for the movie to come out. And secondly, have you seen any shadowy figures following you into bars?
Well, number one, I guess I can say this. I'm not going to go into specifics, but there is going to be a feature film made about Dorothy's life. That we're going to do that. We got that deal made. And what this is all about for me is not the selling books or the movie or anything. It's getting her story out. I just want to restore her reputation and find out who killed her. As far as people following me, I know several people out in the audience here who are a little shady already. So I'm going to watch myself. There's one right there and this woman here. And anyway, but people have asked me, and I was asked today during an interview, whether, I took a chance, I took a risk here by writing the book. Well, when you're an author or you're a journalist, Don out here is somebody who's written about events, and you don't think about that kind of thing. You can't. Because you're what? Searching for the truth. And I've tried to be as close to the kind of a journalist that Dorothy Kilgallen was. So if somebody wants to cause me problems, I've gotten a few strange emails, but otherwise, so far, nothing's happened, and God willing, it will not. Thank you again. Thank you, George.
Such ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion.
Very good. Thank you, George.
Very well.